Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I'm Michael Footer.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros.
And we are excited today. We are going to be talking with Prigwi Yashasan, who is the senior strategist at CCP Games. He's also, he co-leads the analytics department at CCP. We're going to be talking about the intersection of EVE Online as a game and its role, along with other games, as a possible candidate identification and recruiting tool for the game industry. Trigwi, how are you?
Thanks, Michael. I am doing actually pretty good. I have nothing to complain about. What about yourselves?
Doing pretty great. Although, to be fair, when we were before we started recording, and I think we need to get this on the episode because I think everybody needs to hear about this. You're dealing with black fog.
Yeah. So I live on a small island south of Iceland called Westman Islands, and we have black fog, which means that like if I go outside right now and there's a person standing about 3 or 4 meters away from me, I can't see that person, and we've had that now for 3 days.
That's wild. It's like hide and seek expert mode.
Yeah, it's kind of like the beginning of a Stephen King book.
I'm going to take a hard pass on IRL the mist, thanks.
Oh, well. So, other than the black fog, so glad that you are with us today. Hopefully you will not disappear in the middle of the podcast into the black fog. So as we like to do, as we do with all of our interviews, we like to set a foundation and understand where people are coming from. So we ask, what is your origin story? How did you get into the industry?
I got headhunted by our CEO, Hilmarveigur Pétursson, when I was working for the Special Prosecutor's Office in Iceland. Basically, we were investigating. So if you remember 2008, we had a international banking crisis, and Iceland was the first and greatest casualty. We had three major international banks, and they all collapsed within the space of a single week. And what came out of that when the government started a task force was that there were some signs of market manipulation and fraud on an international level and a massive scale. So I was actually on the task force leading some investigations into that. And that is when I crossed path very randomly with Hilmar, the CEO of CCP Games. And I was explaining how I had analyzed basically how high-tech companies should be moving in the international scene. And he kind of liked the way I was analyzing it. And he asked about my background. And I told him a little bit about my background. And he asked if I was a gamer, and I said yes. And then he said, well, we actually have an issue we're dealing with for EVE Online, our game, that somebody like you actually could help us with if you would be interested in it. And would you want to visit CCP headquarters? And I would show you a little bit. And I was like, it wasn't even on my radar to go into the gaming sector, but I thought it was interesting. He was talking about basically a kind of like a black economy that had developed around gambling in EVE Online that they had kind of lost oversight of. It was growing very rapidly, and it had come to the point where the richest players in the game were rich because of they were running basically illegal casinos in the game.
So wild.
Yeah, so they needed somebody to, you know, somebody that could like track money and understand complex systems and analytics, but who was also a gamer and kind of had some background in human behavior. And funnily enough, I kind of checked all of those boxes. And when Hilmar showed me the case and his sales pitch was, if you come work for us, you will get access to the world's greatest behavioral data set, which is at the time 15 years of behavioral data from the socioeconomic world of EVE Online. And that was enough for me to decide to give it a try, and since then I've been hooked.
Numbers life, I love that.
We have had a lot of very interesting origin stories on this show in the months that we've been doing this. I think this is the first where it's like, oh yeah, I worked in the prosecutor's office. That's amazing. I love that. I think that, you know, what's interesting, you know, obviously the behavioral, we've talked about this. We've talked about this a lot, about how in-game economies spring up and how they're studied. And Eve especially is just so interesting from that behavioral and human perspective. And we'll jump into that a little bit. But we're going to be talking today about the Eve effect. Right. So Amanda, why don't you kind of set the stage for us here?
Sure. So one of the things that acted as an inspiration for our conversation today was a white paper that was published on Medium by Andras Horvath and CCP's own internal research. And so that kind of coalesced into what you all are calling the Eve effect. But while we're talking about Eve, and while I think that most folks in the industry know what Eve is, kind of, can you give us a brief synopsis of what the game is for players and for enthusiasts especially that may only kind of know what Eve is, but might not really know how big and how sweeping the world has become?
Yeah, absolutely. So Eve Online is an MMO game that started in 2003. So we now have 17 years and going strong with a really strong player community around us. I was looking at the numbers the other day, and we still have like 70,000 active accounts that are more than 10 years old, which I think is kind of fantastic. And the game itself is most notably known for a couple of things. One is the level of freedom that the players have when they start the game, and which also leads to a level of complexity, which is the game is also known for, because once you join the game, you can pretty much do whatever you want. You can become a space pirate or a diplomat or an industrialist or a fleet commander or whatever you want to do. You can start your own companies. You can invade other companies. You can become a spy. So you have a tremendous amount of freedom, which I've found out through a lot of my studies also gives rise to a very strong sense of identity and purpose in the game, which is really interesting to delve deeper into. And the second element is that if you would ask our player base to describe our game, the number one phrase that comes out is the loss is real. And what they mean by that is it can take a tremendous amount of time and effort to get like to some of the big ships in the game. But then mm-hmm. you can lose them all in like 15 minutes if you make a mistake, and you can't reload, you can't respawn, like those ships are actually gone, which mm-hmm. means that you're really risking something and the loss is palpable. But that also leads to very deep immersions that our players have described to us over and over again, which has created this interesting cocktail that we're calling the Eve effect.
So can you describe what the Eve effect is and how it relates to Horvath's white paper?
Yeah, absolutely. So a few years back, me and Hilmar and some other people at the company, we were discussing what seems to be an epidemic of loneliness in the world. And increasingly every year we have studies showing that, especially in the Western world, more and more people are experiencing feelings of isolation and loneliness. And which is tremendously detrimental to your health, mental and physical. In one study even compared the impact of loneliness being comparable to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And wow. It seems that something is happening in our society, which is leading to a lot of increase in people experiencing this. And a couple of studies really stick in my mind. One was, there was a study in New York that was 1974, I think was the year. So they asked the average New Yorker, how many friends do you have? How many good friends do you have? And I think the criteria was that somebody that you could tell a personal secret to, and the number was 7. It was more than 7. It was like 7 point something. And then they asked it again in 2014, and it was 1 point something. So it was like a complete collapse in it. And other studies have shown that up to 40% of people, especially young people, experience repeat feelings of loneliness and isolation. So we're talking about this at CCP Games, especially in relation to, we just came off of FanFest, which is something that we host every year in Iceland, where players gather to the island in the north and just have fun and cultivate their community. And we had heard so many stories about incredible friendships being made and great groups being built, and which had meaning into their real lives. And we were wondering, like, does a company like CCP, does a gaming company have, you know, any responsibility or potentially an impact for good or for bad into what seems to be a loneliness epidemic? So I decided after that talk that we would send out, actually, we just tacked it onto a survey we were sending out, a question to our players asking them if they had made a friend as a result of playing the game. And I remember we were thinking, like, I wonder how many people, you know, made a friend playing our game. And I was hoping, like, I hope it's something like 15 or 20%, like one out of every five would be awesome. But 73% reported back that they had made a friend, a real friend, as a result of playing the game, which is way higher than I anticipated. And I actually ran this question again in three different surveys over the years. And it's always between 65 and 73%. So it's a really high number that reports making friends. And then in follow-up surveys, we asked if those friendships had been meaningful in their real life. And 62 or 3% said yes, that they were. So that kind of started the company off into a direction where it's like, we need to understand this better. This is huge. This is way bigger than we had realized. Why are so many of our players making friends? And what we found out since then is that this is one of the primary reasons that they stick around, that they're very loyal to the game and to the community, and that they have high levels of satisfaction playing the game. And it also contributes to their real world life. And that's where the second element of the Eve effect comes in, which is real skills. So once we started diving deeper into this, and I'm going really quickly over a really big story that's been sort of developing over the last couple of years, we got a third party company to help us understand how our players were talking about our game and their experience in the game on, like, public forums. So they did a web crawl of the public forums for Eve, and what they found out there is that a lot of players were talking about, like, oh, the skills I gain in the game, the skills I use for my job, the skills I use for real life. So we did a study on that as well. And it turned out that a lot of players claim that they have, you know, landed jobs or become more efficient at work or family because of what they're learning in the game. And we can go deeper into some of those elements later on. And that was a contributing factor into the paper that you just mentioned before.
That's incredible. Like, I'm so fascinated by this intersection. I've been playing MMOs for a really long time, and part of the appeal to me of most massively multiplayer experiences that I've had is in building those connections and is in building those real life, like, leadership skills and stuff like that. So let's dive in. You know, the big takeaway here is that Eve is an extremely complex game that has its own society, economy, ethics, and social norms, but there is that real world skill hook. So can we talk a little bit more about what in-game skills you're seeing manifest in the real world? I guess in meat space, we can call it, because it's all real.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, my CEO wouldn't like you calling it the real world.
Yeah, it's just meat space. I'm just going to dive into it. Listen, I'm a very old Shadowrun player, so it's just meat space. Let's just do it.
Let's do it. All right. Yeah, absolutely. So the number one skill, funnily enough, is spreadsheets and Excel. And if you've played Eve, you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you start your own corporation in the game, if you want to be a successful industrialist tycoon, you know, you want to make money off the market. Pretty quickly, you realize, like, oh, I'm going to have to organize. I'm going to have to keep track of the prices. I'm going to have to figure out, like, where the best pipelines and the most efficient, you know, logistical setups that I can run. And so players will get a really strong incentive to set up something, usually using an outside source like Excel or spreadsheets. And a lot of our players, I think it was like 30 or 33% said that that particular skill, which they cultivated in the game, had been of tremendous use in either work or study. Other skills that scored really high was like leadership. We have really, really awesome stories about players that have been running corps in the game. And they were like, because of what I learned in the game, now I've started my own company, or now I've been promoted at work, and now I use this to, you know, increase morale in my team. And what people that don't play the game probably, I should probably clarify, is that, I mean, I don't even know how to phrase this. So when I'm talking to the players that run some of our bigger corporations, and we can be talking about groups of people with like 10 or 20,000 human beings in it. The sophistication of, you know, the level of commitment that they bring to control, organizing these groups, setting up logistics, maintaining like HR line of, you know, like who takes care of what, who has access to the money, who gets to, you know, take care of the contracts, who is in charge of logistics, maintaining ships, all of this stuff. I mean, some of the players have sent me like hundreds of pages of Google Docs where it's only outlining like how to set up a fleet for newbies. And this is, you know, they're working with real life humans. They're working on a common goal, and they have enemies. You know, they have other humans in other corps who are trying to outpace them, outbeat them, and it leads to like really ambitious level of leadership styles and leadership training. So that was second big one. A third one that was really big also was like market and trading skills, because in EVE, for most players, if they want to go deep into the game, they have to understand the market element, or they start using the market a lot. And it's basically a free market where the players, you know, make all the decisions on the prices, availability, demand, supply, all of that stuff. And you quickly, again, get a really big incentive to understand those elements better. And a lot of the players have told me personally that, you know, they picked up a book on micro or macro economics after they started playing the book, playing the game, because they just wanted to be better.
Oh, that's so cool.
You know, so I think it's important, because we're talking, you know, this is a bigger conversation about human resources and the way that these skills that are being developed in the game, and just understanding the scope of it's important. You know, those 10 to 20,000, these corporations, these large corporations of 10 to 20,000 people,
that
which are
mind.
Large corporate. Yeah, I mean, those are large corporations for Meatspace, right? That's not just in game. That's big. That's comparable to really big companies here, in Meatspace.
I'm delighted that you're using the word Meatspace now.
Like, in the show notes, I have to use it now. It's the rule.
It's the rule.
I think it's important that as we talk about it, especially as there have been a number of HR conversations that have gone on in the gaming world recently for a lot of different reasons, that it's important to understand when we're pulling all of this behavioral data, when we're talking about, you know, all of these people that are involved, to understand a little bit of the demographic breakdown. Can you talk a little bit about the demographics of the people who play EVE? The age breakdown, gender breakdown, geography, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So our biggest, if we start by geography, our biggest player group is Americans. Within the American player group, we have a lot of military, current and ex. We have a lot of like mid-level executives. We have a really high portion of college educated people. The second biggest group is Russians. Then we have our own dedicated server for China, of course. So that is the third or the second biggest group, depending on how you look at it. So these are the three biggest geographical groups. The age has been slowly increasing as the game gets older. Trying to remember what the average age is. It's more than 30. It's like 33 or something. And it grows by about a year on average every year. So the that's also because the audience are growing older with us.
Mm-hmm.
But we have had a lot of change and movements in the demography after we went free to play in 2016. So a lot of new players have been coming in, and especially this year. The big embarrassment for us, and this is something that I really, really want us to improve, and I've been looking into for a couple of months, is that our gender ratios are really bad, or they're really one-sided. We have like, I don't even think we reach 10% female players. So that that is definitely the weak aspect of it.
Okay.
I mean, that's just sometimes the way it tends to go with some kinds of experiences where it seems like, oh, this is a spreadsheet kind of game and I don't necessarily want to use spreadsheets. And I know for me, when I played Eve, oh my goodness, many years ago, I played it with my dad briefly because my dad was a big Eve fan for a long time. And the difficulty curve is kind of what made me run.
Right.
Because I was young. Like, I was, my goodness, it was probably my early 20s. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. This is a lot. But let's keep digging into it, though. Because, I mean, if you all are working towards improving, you know, trying to attract, you know, gender minorities and that sort of thing, like that's an important piece of the strategy, and it's an ongoing effort.
Yeah.
So let's dig into the research a little bit more. So as part of the research, you've noted that the combination of proximity plus frequency plus duration plus intensity leads to meaningful social interactions and friendship potentially. So how do the friendships formed in EVE Online differ from those in other massively multiplayer experiences? You know, is there a difference from other MMOs like World of Warcraft or Final Fantasy XIV that also have baked in guild systems?
Yeah, right. I really like this question. So this is something, this has been my primary focus now for a couple of years. It's studying exactly this. I mean, I haven't studied other MMOs, you know, to the same degree as I can study EVE, and I don't have access to their data. So I would never, claim with a certainty that it is different. I do suspect it is different to a degree because of primarily two variables that I mentioned in the beginning, in the intro. One is EVE gives you a tremendous amount of freedom to be who you want to be and to engage other players whenever you want, however you want, and to whatever level of extremes you want. And because of, we've actually measured this in several different ways, because of the freedom you have, the immersion into the character, the immersion into the self identity, and the self actualization. If we use like Maslow's hierarchy of need, which you actually use a lot for when we're thinking about the development of the game, is really powerful. And if you couple that with what you just mentioned, Amanda, about the friendship formula, we figured out that the friendship formula consists of proximity, duration, frequency, which is very common to have in a lot of situations in life, and a lot of games will have a lot of. But the fourth element, which is the great accelerator, it's like how quickly can you make meaningful social interaction with somebody? Well, you need proximity, you need to meet them frequently, you need to meet them for longer periods of time than just a couple of minutes a day. But if the intensity is really low, if all you do when you meet is just talk courteously about the weather, you're probably not going to become, you know, real good friends, or that connection is not going to matter a lot to you. However, if the intensity is high, if you're talking about something that's really important to you, if you're risking something that's of value to you, then that starts to act as an accelerant where you can make a meaningful connection within a matter of hours instead of, you know, weeks or months. And we found out that EVE excels at exactly this. It's creating moments where people have a lot on the line. It's something that matters a lot to them because they've been building up a company with other players for, you know, months or years. They're in a social structure where they have tremendous amount of freedom to represent, you know, whoever they are. So they feel like they are invested personally in it, or at least their avatar version of themselves or who they want to be or is invested in it. And, you know, they've maybe put 6 months into the vessel that they're flying with the help of other players that they have come to care about and that are relying on them. And then they go into, you know, combat with another organization that they may be, you know, really emotionally charged conflicts with. And this creates something that's just explosively powerful when it comes to connections. And these moments, like dying in fleets with other players in EVE, with all of this on the line, they're what we're calling the magic friendship moments. So I think, you know, without, definitely there are other games that have this in a powerful manner, but with some of the specifics that EVE has combined all of them together, they create really powerful moments.
I want to ask a follow-up question. I love this. And I want to ask a follow-up question based on this. Because one of the aspects, there are two aspects of creating an in-game society and these deep friendships that I feel like the core of those moments, and I've read about, EVE is a fascinating, even if you don't play EVE, it is a fascinating thing to read about when you hear about these huge space battles where like the servers, there has to be like time dilation on the servers in order to take into account the number of ships and players that are kind of, you know, converging on one area. Like that has always fascinated me. But as we're talking about the human element of this, there are two things that stand out to me. One, in any society, you have a set of societal norms, like we talked about, and there needs to be some kind of enforcement of those societal norms.
Yes.
And I'd love to talk a little bit about how that enforcement works, and whether that's something that CCP tries to take a hands-off approach towards, yes, or wants to get hands-on on. And the other piece of this is when you talk about corporate espionage and you talk about spying and you talk about infiltrating other companies, there are relationships that need to be built in order for that sort of thing to accomplish. And I can't imagine, given how strong the friendships are, how deep the betrayal must be if someone is discovered to have been a spy or been working, you know, on the inside against the people who they're trying to befriend.
Right. I'm really happy you asked these questions because they're perfect follow-up and add-on to what we were just talking about. So if we start with the corporation structure, actually it was a very intentional design when the game was designed back in 2003 and 4 to have the corporation structure, which is, you know, you can form your own corporation and that is how your group formation happens, to have a tremendous amount of freedom in that structure. So what is interesting, because I study a lot of the bigger groups, because I'm trying to understand like how you go from a casual player to an elite player, or how you go from a non-engaged newbie to somebody who's now, you know, organizing big fleet fights. And it's very obvious that if you look at like the bigger, more entrenched groups that are very successful and have had like, you know, hundreds of thousands of people sometimes go through them, you know, through a decade, that their credo, that their, you know, indoctrination, that their views on how to, you know, play life matter a lot in what type of groups are formed, what type of people they attract, what type of play style actually comes out on top. And it's really, really interesting to see, like when you're coming in as an observer, and I have this envious position where I get to go and interview the leaders of these corporations, and because I work for the company and they know that I'm trying to make the game better, they often give me a really deep look under the hood of how they actually run things. And it's interesting when you go between these big groups and alliances, how different they are and how different groups can be within the same game, just because of the level of freedom that they can, you know, build the group structure. So that is a massive thing, which means that, you know, you join the game, you have a specific idea of who you are or who you would like to be portrayed in a game. And you're like, I am, you know, I'm a, I'm a vengeful pirate. I don't take no shit. I take no prisoners, and I do things like this. You know, you can find a group with hundreds of players who share those exact sentiments, and they're like, yeah, join us, and we'll be the badass of space. But then, on the flip side of it, you can be like, I just want to help people. I love being in a position where people rely on me, and I can.
Oh, it me.
Yeah, and I can assist them. And in a game like Eve, where there's so much on the line and people need help all the time, you have a really rich and fertile soil to be of use to other human beings. So you can find corporations who are, you know, exactly up that alley. And the interesting thing, though, because we were talking about genders before, is that in these second groups, women often have a much bigger role, and they're often more... in the center of things. This is something that I've come to notice in the last couple of years, and it's a really interesting side story. But I think that is really important to understand, that it matters a lot in Eve what group you can go into. So I would say, you know, you're playing the game, you join a corporation, and you know, you spend maybe 2 or 3 months at that corporation, and you realize, like, I'm actually not enjoying playing this game. You're probably not enjoying playing in that corporation, but you could actually probably find a corporation that would make you love that game if you would have the correct cultural fit and you know. So I've talked to countless players who, like, I started playing the game a couple of times, it was never my style, and then, you know, I found these groups of people and I was like, this is an entirely different game from what I always thought it was. And sorry, you asked the follow-up question. What was that? Sorry.
There was about the betrayals.
Yes, the betrayals, yeah. The betrayal stories at Eve, I remember, so last year I went to a game design convention in Texas, and when it was like all of these big game designers who are like known for having made some of the best games in the history of video games, I was very humbled to be invited to that. And when they heard that there was a person from CCP there, you know, a lot of them came to me like, oh, I love EVE Online. All the best stories are from EVE Online. They're so insane. And what they were, one of the stuff that they were referring to are the betrayal stories. And you have stuff happening there where people go, you know, undercover into another organization and spend like 8 to 10 months. And this is like an actual example, gaining the trust of the leadership, getting access to their coffers, you know, to their bank accounts, to their wallets, getting access to be, you know, in the position of doing extreme damage. And then they spend, you know, a couple of extra months trying to figure out like what is the best time to inflict the most amount of damage, where it can like display the position of their fleet, empty out their bank accounts, like, and then they will do it and they will strike. And, you know, you'll have hundreds of people who are deeply, deeply betrayed. And at the, you know, first hearing about this, you're like, oh, that is horrible. Like, why would anybody want to play that? But when you talk to our players, looking back at it, they often do it with fondness. And they're like, that was the defining moment of my life as a gamer. This is where I decided, like, who am I going to be? Am I going to be meek and humble and forgiving? Or am I going to be, you know, the great Avenger? Or am I going to, you know, continue and power through? Or am I going to quit? You know, and these moments, they become a part of your personality. They become a part of who you are. And that is some of the extremely powerful stories that we get from the game.
Oh, and that has been my experience too. Like, Mike and I have been journalists for a really long time. So what, I think like a decade now, yes. Mike?
Yeah.
It's been a decade for both of us. Haha. If you put them together, we both have 20 years. We have 20 years combined experience. That's upsetting. Right. Okay.
Anyway, we should put that
moving on. Right. Never. No, I'm never putting that on our website. That's horrible. I'm really upset I said that out loud. Anyway, okay, back to the white paper. So the white paper suggests that including gaming on a resume may lead to negative employer perception. And so the, you know, Horvath suggests a number of things to put companies in communication with a game playing audience. So like directly asking about gaming on an application, advertising on the largest enthusiast media sites like Kotaku and IGN, appearing at conferences and conventions, and advertising through game subreddits. So this got Mike and I thinking, again, about demographics and stuff like that. So I don't know if this is
part of the data that you all collect, but we figured that we just wanted to ask the question anyway. So what portion of players of games like Eve visit enthusiast media sites, like attend general gaming conventions or visit game subreddits at all? And, you know, how do you ensure that you aren't missing those prime candidates that can't afford to attend conventions or only identify as fans of one or two games? As we know, it's not it, like the conversation around games has very much so become a which game do you play, not which genre do you play, unlike when we were younger, when it was just like a shotgun blast of single player games. And therefore don't necessarily like find value in visiting major media outlets that have a more broad focus. So all that to say, like, how do you ensure that you aren't missing out on those prime candidates that don't necessarily fall into the traditional vehicles for gaming advertising?
Oh, wow. that's a tough question. I'm not even sure I know the answer to that. I could tell you a lot of stories where, because we, funnily enough, a lot of people that play Eve run their own companies. And we actually have a person, for example, on the CSM who is the head of a company who is actually bigger than CCP Games, which is very interesting. The CSM is the Council of Stellar Management, which is the player council that gets elected every year. And we fly them to Iceland to help us develop the game and represent the player interest to the company.
Ah, okay. So there's that. There's another piece of that crossover between in-game and meat space. That's really interesting.
Right, right. And some of those people have told us that, you know, they actually populate their company and they often hire people that they've played within the game because they've then, you know, seen that they are can be relied upon, that they're trusting, or that they're good with like human relations, all of that stuff. But in terms of your question, like, how do you find somebody who isn't engaging to that degree? I'm not sure. I'm sorry. I don't think I have the answer to that.
That's okay. It was worth asking the question anyway, because it's a complex set of data that can, like, and sometimes those prime candidates and looking at folks that don't fall into those neat little buckets, it can sometimes just kind of get lost in the shuffle. So it was worth asking the question regardless.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting, you know, I read the white paper and I looked at the materials that you guys sent along to get a real understanding of kind of the broader games perspective and then the specifically CCP perspective. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, first of all, again, the whole fascinating aspect of having to develop those skills to excel in the game. And of course, because those core skills are based on things that have to happen in the real world, like supply chain management, like human resources.
Yeah.
And making sure that you understand how to do this. That is all entirely fascinating. It's when we start talking about, okay, taking that game playing audience and specifically an Eve audience and then extrapolating that out into finding good candidates. And that's kind of where the white paper lives, is finding good candidates through gaming who may not be self-identifying for a variety of reasons, the primary reason being employers that don't understand games and don't understand the complexity, especially of games like Eve, may look down on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I kind of want to pull that camera back from the specificity of the question, that the previous question that we put together, and ask, you know, what are the most important things that companies like CCP are looking for in a candidate for a job in gaming, and how can targeting a gaming audience surface those attributes? We know they're there, right? Obviously, especially in games like Eve, where you're managing companies of 10,000, 20,000, or operating in those companies, and therefore learning those skills because you have to interact with them.
Right.
But surfacing those skills in an audience, especially through things like a subreddit where people might not show their best self.
Exactly. So, mm-hmm. So if you apply for a job at CCP Games, there's a mandatory question to answer is, you know, first of all, are you a gamer? And the second of all, you know, what type of games do you play? because we feel and our HR department feels that there is a lot of insight to be had in a lot of the cases from, you know, seeing like what type of gamer people self-describe as and what type of games they play in relation to like what type of skills can you expect them or like skill range can you expect them to be familiar with. And this is often, I mean, we haven't done any specific studies on this per se, but it's often, you know, if you know somebody plays a game like, you know, like some of the really complex, you know, war management games like Victoria and Total War and some of these franchises, this is like a min-max micromanagement type of game set. And if you're playing these games for a few years, you're going to have certain skills, you're going to have certain, you know, attention to detail, you're going to, you know, you're going to be able to find, you know, some of the extra bucks laying around in improving things like efficiency, stuff like this. It's just very likely that if you enjoy playing those games, that you will have skills or at least the interest levels to create value in those areas. And I think HR personnel, especially in gaming, are increasingly aware of this type of stuff. And that is why it is really important for like our HR departments. They keep up to date on what games are being played, what is characterizing them. They go to these gaming conventions. They get familiar with, you know, like, why is everybody playing Fortnite? What does that mean? Why are so many people playing Battlegrounds? What are the skills behind there? What could we expect from a Battleground player? And then, of course, once you've had hundreds of people roll through your roster who've told you what type of games they play and they've self-identified, and then you've seen how, what type of employer or what type of you know, job performance they give, you start to put things together. And often, I would say often this is an indication on par with like what type of education did you choose. It's actually, in some cases, it's really powerful.
Man, I'm so fascinated by that. One of the things that I thought a lot about when I was coming into like looking for a job for the first time after university is, you know, how do I capitalize on all the hours I used to spend playing WoW with my dad? Like, how do I talk about that on my resume? I think that, you know, 15 years ago, it probably wouldn't have been a good idea, but I love the fact that there are more employers that are opening themselves up to education and to better understanding, you know, how interactive entertainment is really shaping how people show up at work as well as how they show up in game, which is just amazing.
Yeah. And I think this is just the latest trend, you know, in a long trend going back decades where the employment market recognizes that, for example, like if you played team sports as a kid, that means that, you know, you have certain efficiencies on, like, you know how to be on a team, you know that you can't just always get, you know, what you want through. You have to show up for practice, you know, you have to have a certain level of discipline, especially if you manage to play at some, you know, upper division level. And anybody who's been at all familiar with sports, which nowadays most people have, you know, some sort of touch point and they understand the discipline and everything that goes into that, they recognize that if you get like somebody applying for a job and he was like, you know, on the national track and field team, you probably assume that, like, okay, that person probably has discipline, that person probably is willing to work hard, you know, a couple of things. And I think gaming is just the latest addition to that. I mean, you could say the same thing about like instruments. If you reached a certain level of playing an instrument, you know that, you know, you have neurological pathways activated that allow you to do certain things that a person who hasn't played an instrument is allowed to do. So I think gaming is just the latest in a long line of human experiences where we're understanding that, like, somebody who has run a corporation in EVE Online that has been successful for years and he's like had, you know, 2,000 people run through it, that isn't something that just any Joe Schmuck could do.
Mm-hmm. True. Absolutely.
So my follow-up question, because we, you know, I position that as a, you know, looking for a candidate as a job in gaming, obviously different fields within meat space companies have their own professional groups. You've got accountants, you've got lawyers. HR folks have their own professional groups and they do professional development. how is this information about the value of playing games like Eve and the skills that are learned in games like Eve moving out of the gaming sphere into the wider HR sphere?
Yeah. So, I mean, that is one of the primary reasons we wanted to put our weight behind putting some of the research we're doing out there into the HR sphere, because we felt like we've spent time researching this. We're seeing very tangible results, and we want other companies to be able to learn from this and up their game. And for example, we're working now with the University of Iceland, creating course material on the friendship machine and the Eve effect, because we want, nice. And we're just distributing this for free through the TED Education learning portal, because we want to, we want to put our weight to accelerate this conversation. And I think, I mean, I'm not personally, an HR person, but I think in every year you can just see, the developments, for example, just with LinkedIn articles being shared and the HR community is very active there. So the knowledge and understanding about this, I think, is rapidly being disseminated. And I would be really surprised, especially if you would go to high tech companies right now in the West, if you would find a lot of HR departments who would be completely oblivious to this, or I hope at least that's the case, but I might be mistaken.
Okay, so from an HR perspective then, so what advice do you have for HR professionals looking to staff up a game company, and what do you recommend candidates prioritize on their resumes and in their cover letters?
So that is going to depend a lot on the position per se. So it's hard to, I think, generalize it, because the positions in a gaming company are so widespread and varied. But if I try to narrow it down on the topic that we're discussing, we've seen time and time again, especially when it comes to the development structure naturally, but increasingly also in the marketing structure and the customer structure, that if you get candidates that have a lot of experience with gaming and they understand stuff, like, because there's formulas, right? If you play a lot of games, you start realizing like there are formulas for like how to make a good tutorial, what is the loop of going from being a novice to an expert in a game, like what does that require, right. How does basic user experience, UX experiences, like how important are they and how do they affect stuff? And if you have somebody who has never played a game or who doesn't play a lot of games, and they're completely oblivious to like how important, like a simple UI can be or to not have too much text and stuff. And like that is a lot of ground to cover for starting at a gaming company, to just be a part of the conversation from where it needs to happen, I think. So I think this needs to be recognized, and it increasingly is being recognized. And then the second element of it is, if I was an HR person and I was, looking for a good game designer or a QA or a UX designer or a programmer, and I was trying to ask good questions regarding gaming, I would try and understand like, hey, tell me about what type of games do you like the best and why. And, what is your favorite game? And then not start with too focused of a question, because then you maybe miss something really beautiful. Because like my previous experience before going to CCP was interrogating. And I've led like hundreds of interrogations. And it's an art to try to get, the actual truth and the actual intent of a person. Because a lot of the time people are just looking to say what they think you want to hear. So you have to kind of ask an open question and allow them to be like, hey, tell me why you love this, or why do you play this so much? And, for the first couple of sentences, they may be, okay, they're probably looking for something stellar. Like I love respecting people and I love the diligence. But, it is incredibly obvious, actually, if you're interviewing people, when they go from just telling you what you want to hear to what they actually care about, because their entire demeanor, their facade will change considerably. But it's a It's a trick to not always fill the silences. I always say, if I'm training people to interrogate, I always say your best friend is a strategically positioned silence, because people will want to fill that silence, and often they will start then to go into this flow state of like, okay, what I actually do love is the other day, me and my friend were doing this, and you know, somebody attacked us, and I just loved how we stuck together, and then you know, so trying to get to the heart of like, why do they love that game? Because once you understand why somebody loves something and why they spend a lot of time on it, you understand their motivation, or most likely you will understand a lot about their motivation and what they may bring to the company as an asset. And games are all about your, you know, passion, motivation, what you love to do, because nobody forces you to play games. You just choose what you're really interested in and love to do. And those games that you play a lot of, you know, spend a lot of time in, they have something that's really deeply connected to who you are as a person. And once you understand that, like, okay, that person plays, you know, Subnautica because he loves figuring out mysteries. So if I will throw that person into like, we need to figure out why we're losing players here, he would probably spend, you know, a lot of hours, because he showed me he has 1,000 hours on Subnautica. Like, this type of insights, I think you're looking for. And the better you understand the games and the genres, and the more strategic silences you insert, I think the closer you can come to getting like valuable personal insights that can often be so difficult to achieve as an HR person in the short windows that you have with the candidates.
Excellent. Thank you so much. This conversation has been so fascinating. I have loved every single moment of it. Wow.
Same.
So thank you for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Virtual EconCast. I am at Footerish, FUTTERISH.
And I'm at Amanda Farrow.
Yes. Trigby, where can people find you online if they wanted to follow you, because you are fascinating?
Well, thank you. You're too kind. I actually have a kind of limited online profile. I do have an Instagram just under my name, and then I do have I'm most active on Facebook actually. So under my name, Tryggvi Hjaltason. People are probably gonna have a problem spelling that.
That's
out.
All right. It's gonna be in the show notes. We got you.
All right.
And if this is your first time listening to Virtual Economy, you can subscribe to our RSS feed at virtualeconomy.libsyn.com/RSS. You can also listen to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and Google Play and Stitcher and Pocket Casts, Pocket Sand.
Yeah, we have
more.
To do it.
We have to. if you haven't yet subscribed, we would love it if you do. And if your platform of choice allows you to review the show, we would love to know what you think. You can also DM us with questions, or if you prefer email, you can send them to podcast@fsquared.biz.
Well, speaking of F Squared, Mike.
Oh, yes.
Virtual Economy is, in fact, an F Squared initiative. And along with pro bono business consulting for up and coming developers, it's a way we are working to give back to the community that has already given us so much. To find out more about F Squared and the services we can provide, including pitch prep, media training, mock reviews, and business strategy guidance, visit our website at fsquared.biz. So we will be back very soon for our news show. And in the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.
See you soon.